It might be safe to say that Cindy Adams likes a challenge. I remember meeting her about 10 years ago because of her work with the Meth Project, an organization she co-founded. It was at a time when crystal meth was rearing its ugly head and tightening its grip on our community. She now heads the Aloha United Way at a time when the agency marks its centennial and when social service needs may be at an all-time high. She sat down with us this morning.
One of the things I really appreciated about the Meth Project was that we were working upstream, meaning focused on prevention. And our target audience was teenagers, of course, both in private and public schools. And it was what was particularly interesting was the significant amount of interest among that audience for this kind of information. And I think given in some households, this is methamphetamine addiction is a multi-generational issue. And the fact that, you know, we can all remember when we were teenagers, right? How we sometimes don't connect actions with consequences in a way that really creates an appreciation for what that means and how it can change our lives. It was a really great mission. I really enjoyed doing that work. And I had conversations with a number of donors over that period of time and asked them why they were inspired to support our work. And one of the answers that I got that I will never forget and still speak about today is we have so many social issues in Hawaii, great needs to address, and taking a little bit of philanthropy dollars or donors and investing upstream in prevention actually helps to reduce the downstream costs of issues that we're experiencing today. And that really stuck with me and very relevant to the work that we're doing at Aloha United Way today.
The social service needs have probably never been greater when we look at our homeless crisis, our housing crisis.
Right. Yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of interesting, I think. It's so visible today, particularly in terms of homelessness, that sometimes people don't realize that it's something that is built up over many years. Like, you know, I'll pick a number, like 30 years, right? We've had an affordable housing crisis for over that period of time, much longer than that as well. So these are things that build upon each other, which is what makes the problem so complex and a challenge to address, not something that can be addressed within 1 or 2 years. So it takes a significant effort from a broad spectrum of stakeholders, business, nonprofits, government, philanthropy, to come together to address issues like this, especially deeply systemic issues.
And Aloha United Way has this model of reaching out across the board in a company and asking for kokua, just because you could have a situation where a member is touched by a meth addiction or some other, you know, social ill.
Yes, that's a really great point. And I think one of the things that's very unique to United Way, to Aloha United Way, is this opportunity to reach out across the community and give everybody in our community an opportunity to make a donation to programs and services, particularly programs and services that have touched them personally, whether it's their own family, friends, neighbors, people at work that you know. I don't think there's probably more than 1 or 2 degrees of separation for most of us who live here in Hawaii. And so it's a tremendous opportunity for people to support the organizations that provide those programs and services to our community.
So talk about the ALICE program, because that's something that you folks launched. And I think you were also working with, I think, Servco, which also,
yes,
I think, is marking its 100th anniversary as well.
Yeah, so we're both celebrating our centennials this year, and Servco made a very significant grant to Aloha United Way for our ALICE work. And ALICE is an acronym that stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. So these are working families and individuals in our community who still struggle every month to make ends meet. And this segment of our population, which is 37% of all the households across Hawaii, across our state, It doesn't take more than one or two, I would say, relatively small, $400 to $500 unexpected expense to cause these households to become very much at risk of incremental financial kind of downward spiral, right? So if you think about, you know, if you have a medical expense that you didn't expect or anticipate, or let's say somebody got the flu, a wage earner got the flu and was out of work for 2 or 3 weeks, which is not uncommon, and you're holding down 2 or 3 jobs, that is a loss of income to your family, and that has a very significant impact when you're looking at how you pay bills on a regular basis. And so falling behind on a credit card bill, falling behind on monthly rent or utilities has a very important impact to these families. It affects their food stability, affects a number of things. And so that's why we're very interested in serving ALIS households. Much of the federal and state funding that comes into Hawaii serves federal poverty level and below. And so ALIS families are very much at risk, very vulnerable financially. And so we're working with a group of 10 agencies, 10 nonprofits, who are delivering programs and services to these households. We just started funding this work in January 1 of this year, so it's very early. We made a commitment to fund them for a minimum of 3 years. To learn more about how we can better serve ALIS families and individuals in our community, help them to be much more stable financially, and ultimately to help them move up financially.
Do we know what portion of the folks that might tap those ALIS funds might be immigrants?
That's a great question. There's clearly some segment of that population, of our population, who are in fact immigrants. There are immigrants who come over who are professionals and sometimes struggle with finding the same kinds of opportunities that they had at home in terms of earning capacity here in Hawaii for a number of reasons, either because of the tight job market. We have very low unemployment still here in Hawaii, which makes it very competitive. And so to answer your question, yes, some of these households are in fact immigrant families. There are also immigrant families who fall below the federal poverty level in Hawaii as well. And we know that number for federal poverty level is about 10% of our households in Hawaii. So when we talk about ALIS and below, you take the 37% ALIS, 10% federal poverty level, that's 47% of our households across the state. So it's almost one in every two that have challenges financially.
Wow, so you could just go down the block, and that's it just shows how we're really all on thin ice.
Yes, yes. And it's, you know, it affects when we think about resiliency of communities. Oftentimes we think about it in terms of some sort of a natural disaster, a hurricane, an earthquake, a fire, that sort of thing. But when we think about, stop and think about economic resiliency in relation to an economic downturn like a recession, or even as a result of a natural disaster, right? If we are not financially stable as a family, as a community, it makes it so much more challenging for us to come back from things that affect our lives and to maintain a healthy community.
Hawaii has always been, though, pretty generous, I think, right? I mean, even though we don't have a lot, families are willing to give.
Yes, that is so true. We have thousands of nonprofits that serve our families here in Hawaii. And we know through the Aloha United Way annual campaign that people who live here are very generous and considerate. And I think it comes from being an island state where we, and the host culture, right? This is about how do we take care of each other, because we can't, you know, somebody can't drive across a state line to help Hawaii. And so I think as a result of that, we have a spirit of community and a spirit of generosity that helps us to take care of our own.
Cindy Adams is a president and CEO of Aloha United Way, which kicked off its giving campaign earlier this month. AUW was established in 1991 by Frank Atherton and has raised more than $677 million over the years to help create change.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, whose students contribute 60,000 hours of community service annually. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
You know, Representative Ed Case, who sits on the House Appropriations Committee, expressed concern last week that federal money for several military projects in Guam is being diverted for a border wall. It was the same concern he had earlier this year. Case disagreed about moving funds for Hawaii military for the president's wall. One project that had been on the chopping block was a $78 million effort to upgrade the Pearl Harbor-Waiava water system. A major break in the line recently underscored the need to overhaul the aging system. Case also sits on the Natural Resources Committee, giving him plenty of opportunities to work with his sister, Suzanne, who heads the State Department of Land and Natural Resources. We sat down with him earlier this summer as he reflected on his return to Congress.
This is my third tour of duty, so to speak, in Washington, D.C. I mean, I went to Washington, D.C. as a summer intern for Spark Matsunaga, then U.S. House member Spark Matsunaga, my predecessor representing the 1st Congressional District, 44 years ago. And I spent 3 years on Capitol Hill from the age of 22 to 25 then, half of it in the U.S. House, half of it in the U.S. Senate. I decided that that was a career I wanted to pursue. You know, long story short, that took me back to Congress in 02. I served 02 to 07, very, very full, 4+ years. Came home, lived a normal life, if you want to put it that way, for 12 years of great practicing law and then working for Outrigger Hotels, which I loved doing. But what really happened was that I watched the country deteriorate. I watched the political debate deteriorate. I watched Congress deteriorate. I watched this incredible divisions coming in. And in that, I wasn't different from any other American, I don't think. And then I got wrapped up in a group called the Reformers Caucus. And this was only just last year. It was a was and remains a group of former members of Congress on a bipartisan basis. Former members of Congress, cabinet officials, ambassadors, senators, governors, you know, folks that have been involved in government. And the commitment of the Reformers Caucus was to reform government, to try to bring it back closer to the people, to try to end some of this division. And at some point, I just thought to myself, well, you know, if I'm going to get back involved in politics, I'd rather do it from the inside. And that took me to running for this particular election.
Now, you managed to get on two really important committees, appropriations and environment. You were concerned about funding for the military's water system at Pearl Harbor. We just had a major break, and we just had a recent one up at Tripler.
So this is actually a very instructive story, especially the water main break for the military coming out of Waiava, which is their main water supply to Pearl Harbor and all of the military installations that are on or related to Pearl Harbor, plus many, many civilians. So we're talking 100,000 people that depend on one water pipe from Waiava coming down. And that water pipe, everybody has known that it needed to be replaced. And it was already in the pipeline, so to speak, for funding. So the funding was actually appropriated. So not just authorized, but appropriated. The difference there is authorized means, yes, you can do it. Appropriated means, okay, you're going to do it, and here's the money. The money had already been appropriated for that. The project is about a $78 million project. And this is military construction money, which falls directly within my Appropriations Committee Subcommittee on Military Construction and Veterans. That's one of my key subcommittees, where there's 10 of us out of 435 in Congress that are responsible for divvying up a huge amount of funding for those areas. Right in the middle of that project actually being contracted for, President Trump determined that he wanted to divert all currently appropriated monies for military construction, or not all, but much of it, to his border wall on the basis of it being an emergency funding. Now, we can debate whether their border wall needs to be built or not. I'm fine debating that. We can also debate whether it's an emergency. The key here was that Congress had already appropriated the money. It was already allocated to that project, and he proposed to divert it. Now, I said that that was wrong in committee. I flew home, and the next day that water main breaks. So proof in the pudding right there. The other committee that I was really, really happy to get onto was Natural Resources. And when you serve on appropriations, it's what's referred to as an exclusive committee, which means you're not supposed to serve on another committee unless there's a really good reason. I was fortunate to get a waiver to that so that I get to serve on Appropriations and Natural Resources. The Natural Resources Committee is responsible for basically anything having to do with our natural resources, as the name connotes. So we're talking about national parks, national forests, public lands, our oceans. Those are areas that are within that committee's kuleana.
I'm sure you probably get an earful from Suzanne.
Referring to my sister, yes. Who's the chair of the Department of Land and Natural Resources. Well, in all honesty, it's fantastic to have her there while I'm on this committee, because My job is to work with the state of Hawaii to start with on trying to achieve the state's priorities and purposes in Washington, D.C. So in the area of natural resources, it's natural for me, so to speak, to work with DLNR. And Governor Ige has been very, very good about saying, hey, just work directly with my cabinet members. Now, it just so happens that that particular member is my sister. We grew up exactly the same way on the Big Island. We have the same viewpoint on the environment. We have the same concerns for the environment. And so it is really, really nice to just call her up and say, hey, you know, I've got this issue. What do you think? Or similarly with her. And, you know, what do we do about it at the federal level? So that's been a real joy to do. The area that particularly concerns me on the environment is our oceans. National policy on our environment tends to focus more on our air and on our terrestrial environment. And so we spend a lot of time talking, as we should, on the natural resources about, you know, climate change, about the impacts of climate change on our national parks, national forests, and other parts of our environment. We tend to spend a lot of time talking about how do we protect the environment on land throughout our country, but we don't spend a whole bunch of time on our oceans. And, you know, in all honesty, a lot of folks in Congress, they just don't think about oceans.
Right, landlocked.
They're landlocked. They're from Kansas. You know, if they think about oceans, they think more about the Atlantic Ocean. They're not familiar with the Pacific Ocean. So it's really not a champion of the Pacific Ocean, especially the tropical, subtropical Pacific Ocean in Congress. And so I've taken that up. I mean, my goal in the environmental area is to deal with our world's oceans. And that comes from a couple of different areas. You know, one would be the basic natural resources of our oceans, so the fisheries of our oceans. Are they overfished? Are we managing it correctly? Are we coordinating with other countries of the world so that we, you know, save our whales and, you know, save our endangered species in the oceans? Another area that is equally important is non-point source pollution, especially from land. So seepage from land into the oceans just destroys oceans. And so I'm finding my fellow travelers, so to speak, in Congress to deal with how do we fashion a national oceans policy that will actually effectively manage and protect our oceans for the next generations.
You talked about transparency, the need for transparency, and you also mentioned the fisheries. And I know the Fisheries Council is something that you're concerned about whether we're getting proper accounting about certain funds they may be managing. Any headway on that?
I think there is a lot of headway. First of all, we're talking about the Western Pacific Fisheries Management Council, which is a product of federal law. And what they're supposed to be doing is essentially managing the fisheries in U.S. waters in the Western Pacific, which includes Hawaii. So there's a number of fisheries management councils for U.S. waters throughout our country. We're in the Western Pacific. And so the Western Pacific Management Council, WESPAC for short, has been doing this for many, many decades now. And I believe that they have gotten themselves into really a culture of kind of, you know, insider focus, and certainly a feeling that, you know, the way they do things is the way they should be done and nobody can challenge them. We have been, and this has been going on long before I was reelected to Congress, we have been trying to get them to provide the basic information about where they spend their money. Now, you would think that with the sum total of the, you know, many members of the delegation asking them to produce their information and Freedom of Information Act requests, that we would now know where they are actually contracting, the terms of the contracts, and where they are actually spending their money. And the answer is we don't right now. So certainly with other members, we haven't gotten all the information yet. So unfortunately, this is not a simple process. But we are making headway to answer your question.
Okay, so just efforts to try and manage not just the natural resources, but also then what's happening with the funds.
Well, you give WESPAC the responsibility for our federal government to manage the fishery in one of the largest swaths of the ocean in the entire world. You want to know what they're doing. I certainly do. I'm responsible for it. I'm funding them to do that. I'm supposed to be overseeing them. And if I don't have the basic information to oversee them, I'm not doing my job.
That was a rebroadcast of a conversation we had with Representative Ed Case, who happened to be in town over the 4th of July holiday. He was talking about his first 6 months working back in Washington, D.C.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from NLX, launching Smart Charge Hawaii in collaboration with Hawaiian Electric, offering 300 juice box electric vehicle smart chargers to drivers and 50 to businesses. evcharging.enelx.com/Hawaii.
What to do about our prisons? That's a question the state's been asking, and that's the subject of our reality check. Joining us today is Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Yu Hyun Jung. Good morning.
Good morning.
So your story is about the Oahu Community Correctional Center, and that project is stalled?
Yeah, well, there is no funding for it, and nobody wants to pay for it, and the city council has asked for a 120-day extension on approving the permit for the construction project.
I'm just scratching my head because I just think with the state of prisons these days, you know, with the Maui riot that we saw, and in the past we've had the situation with the lawsuits and federal oversight, that we're taking a chance here.
Yeah, but the state still very much wants to push forward with the project because, you know, this is very much just an extension. The state is still waiting to hear if this permit will be approved. It's still going forward. There's no plan, as far as we know, to stop this project. The governor's office told me that the important environmental work has been done. As you know, last year they completed the final environmental impact statement, and it's going forward.
Yes, but it just seems that's so frustrating that it's moving so slow when, you know, we needed this yesterday.
But there's no money for it. You know, the legislature didn't appropriate any money for it. And, you know, there was talk of that public-private partnership with CoreCivic, you know, mentioned as one of the prime candidates. If you don't know who that is, CoreCivic was formerly known as Corrections Corporation of America. It operates the Saguaro Correctional Center, where some of our inmates are housed in Arizona. And they also operate private prisons all across the United States. But, you know, there was no decision made out of that. So there's no current funding for this project. And, you know, Tony Schwartz, who is the spokeswoman for the Public Safety Department, is saying that it's actually kind of premature to talk about funding at this point because the conceptual design has not been decided.
And I know there are folks in the community who say building a new prison isn't the answer, that we need more programs to, you know, rehab folks that are in prisons now and to rethink our prison system in general.
Absolutely. There are folks who, you know, think the new prison should be smaller. And then there are folks who think, no, the whole process should be rethought altogether, as in there should be no new prison, because as it stands, the people who are in the prison system, you know, you got to think about who's in there right now. If you look at the data itself, a lot of the people who are in the system right now happen to be pretrial detainees, as in they haven't been convicted of anything yet. And then there are the folks who are probation violators who could be in there for a couple of days or maybe a week or more. So they're in there for a really short time. And then there are people who are in there for really low-level offenses. So they make up about 78% to 80% of the population. So if you think about that, those folks can be diverted to community-based programs. That's a lot of people who don't need to be in prisons, or that's what reform advocates are saying. And in that case, you don't need a whole new big prison.
And what's the council's concern for the reason for the delay?
So at least one of them, Carol Fukunaga, whose district this new prison would fall on, she just thinks that not a lot of meaningful dialogue has happened around it, you know, and she just has a lot of questions that she feels like were unanswered.
Okay, well, let's hope that they move on this soon. But thanks so much, Yuyun.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was our reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Yuyun Jung. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also things we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips and welcoming him back now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, the bright planets of Jupiter and Saturn continue to grace us with their presence in the evening sky. Both planets can be seen towards the southwest after sunset. The moon this week is passing through its first quarter phase and as such will become increasingly bright by week's end.
I understand you have news about the world's largest radio telescope going online?
Indeed, it is by far the world's largest radio telescope, and it has opened its ear and its doors to astronomers and the cosmos. The 500-meter aperture spherical radio telescope in southern China is now the largest operational radio telescope, with a diameter twice that of the famous Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. This enormous and highly sensitive observatory has astronomers around the world excited at the prospect of a new era in radio astronomy.
And this sounds exciting, but will China be allowing astronomers from other places to access the instrument or be sharing the information that they get from it?
Yes, they will be completely open. In fact, Chinese astronomers have already had access to this observatory since 2016 during the testing phase, in which they found 100 pulsars. And now they're going to open it up to astronomers from around the world who can submit observing proposals and pick their own targets out there in the universe.
And I had read that when they were first designing this, they had an eye on looking for extraterrestrial life and that sort of thing. What can you provide us in terms of targets they've got?
Well, you're not wrong there. This radio telescope will be used to study exoplanets in our search for extraterrestrial life. But it will be also used to study extremely faint and distant radio sources in the universe, such as those mysterious fast radio bursts we've heard about, and also pulsars, clouds of molecular gas, and distant galaxies.
And it's already online, or we're going to be waiting for it to fire up and be available to people soon?
It's online right now, so we can probably expect data to come in over the next year or so.
We'll be looking for the new information here on Stargazer with you, Christopher Phillips. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Information Technology and Communication Primary Facility at McMurdo Station, Antarctica. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, ferrarochoi.com.
As we just keep our gaze to the stars, members of the University of Hawaii's Institute for Astronomy recently witnessed a far-off star being ripped apart by a supermassive black hole. Team member Benjamin Chappie spoke with The Conversation's Harrison Patino to break down the findings.
So I'm part of a team called the All Sky Automated for Supernovae, or it's called Assassin. It's headed up at OSU, but there's a bunch of us around the United States and the world. We have multiple telescopes, one here in Hawaii, Texas, Chile, South Africa, and soon to be China. And so how we made this discovery is that one of our robotic telescopes, which was in South Africa, saw an increase in brightness from the center of the host galaxy of this tidal disruption event. So what a tidal disruption event is that if a star in the very center of a galaxy happens to wander too close to a supermassive black hole, so at the center of every big galaxy, like our Milky Way, there's a supermassive black hole that's a million to a billion times the mass of our sun. And so if a star happens to wander too close to that supermassive black hole, it can get literally ripped apart or sheared because the difference in gravity from the front side of the star to the back side can overwhelm the gravity of the star itself.
So from what I understand, these sorts of really massive happenings in space that astronomers are able to observe, it's not like you're getting a 4K high-definition video of it. So what exactly was your team able to observe, quote-unquote, of it?
Yeah, so it's literally just like a point in the star, a point in the sky, kind of like a star getting brighter. And then when we go to bigger telescopes after we see that in ASSASSIN, or space-based telescopes like TESS and SWIFT, that we then can get a more complete picture across frequency or color, but it's still just a point source, so it's still just a single point in the sky that's getting brighter. But we can resolve the host galaxy, so the galaxy that's in it, you can actually get a picture of that, although it's probably not the pretty pictures that you're thinking of in your head of really nearby beautiful spiral galaxies. It's actually, even the galaxy is relatively small and kind of just a smudge.
How rare are these kinds of events?
In a galaxy like our own, they'll happen about once every 10,000 years. So they're pretty rare. So you have to look at a lot of galaxies in the nearby universe to even be able to see one of these events occurring.
I don't even want to get into the probability of being able to see this event, so I'm sure it was miraculous. But how much did luck play a part in this? I understand you have a sort of a platoon of telescopes pointed at the sky, but was it just the right moment that you guys happened to check your data?
Yeah, so between our survey and other surveys that are here in Hawaii and around the world, between all of us, we've been able to find a couple of these per year. What's particularly special of this event is that when we found the event, we then realized it was in the exact patch of sky that TESS, a spacecraft, the Transit Exoplanet Explorer satellite from NASA, was looking at the same time. And they've been looking at this patch of sky for months. And to find planets, it has to take very precise measurements of how bright stars are. And so it's a very, very precise instrument that happened to be looking at the same exact part of the sky every 30 minutes for months. So that was the really lucky part about this observation, is that we discovered it and then realized that in a couple of weeks we were going to get the data download from TESS and basically see it brightening from nothing in the SOS galaxy.
So in terms of actually being able to observe these are pretty rare events. So I'm assuming that the actual data, the knowledge set that we understand about these TDEs, might be somewhat limited. So what did you guys know about tidal disruption events before this discovery, and what do you think you learned from it that you guys didn't know before?
Yeah, so we're still just barely scratching the surface of these events. And each one that we discover, again, there's only a handful that have been discovered, something like 30 total candidates of all of astronomy. And most of those don't have anywhere near the observations we have on this guy. But each one is special in its own way. So we're still in the phase where we're trying to, like, you know, if you were looking at insects or something, right, we have a bunch of different types, and we're trying to still piece together exactly how they work. And so a picture is starting to emerge for all of them, but there's still a huge number of questions to be answered. Because in astronomy, typically all we get is, like, we know that it got brighter for how long it got brighter, basically the colors of how long it got brighter. So just in those little clues, we have to piece together what's actually happening.
Now, in this release, one of your colleagues from ASSASSIN said that this is the new poster child for TDE research. You care to elaborate on that?
Yeah, so just the observations that we got are unique. So most of these, it's easier to find something when it's brighter, if you can think of your daily life. And so most of the tidal disruption events are discovered right around peak brightness or a little bit after. So they slowly get brighter over the course of a month or 40 days, and they start to fade. So in ASSASSIN on this one, we discovered it very early, about 20 days before max. We were able to get spectroscopy, if you think of like Pink Floyd's album cover where you break the light into a rainbow. We basically do that on telescopes and take a picture of that rainbow. And we got that extremely early. We were able to get SWIFT observations, and SWIFT is another NASA satellite, which can get UV and X-ray observations that we can't get here on Earth. And we got that extremely early as well. And then the test data basically sees it rising from almost nothing. So the whole first part of the rise of this event, there's a huge amount of information about physically what's going on in the system that's imprinted on those observations that we just have never had before anywhere near this detail.
So this is a quote straight from you, but you said the excitement is likely to keep coming. What exactly do you mean by that?
Yeah, so we're getting better and better at finding transients, those things that change in the sky earlier, or as early as possible. test is now looking in the northern hemisphere. So before it was looking in the southern hemisphere last year, and this year is looking in the north, where our telescopes here in Hawaii can find them. So this particular object was too far south for basically any of our telescopes here in Hawaii to get observations of. But in the future, we'll be able to find transients that are in tests. We're already doing that in the test field of view, and then get a large amount of follow-up data from telescopes right here.
I was just going to ask, did this discovery, do you think it makes finding these TDE events easier in the future, or is it still just a complete luck of the draw when you're pointing telescopes out into the galaxy?
So it makes us a little bit more confident when we find something to distinguish tidal sorption events from other transients. So lots of things, lots of explosions happen in galaxies. There are supernovae when stars explode. We also find those. There's also these supermassive black holes at the center of the galaxies that rip apart the star. They also eat gas and dust in their host galaxies, and those are called active galactic nuclei. And so distinguishing between when a star gets ripped apart and just accretion of gas and dust, so eating of gas and dust, has been a bit of a challenge. One of the observations that we made here using TESS is that this tidal sorption event is extremely smooth. It doesn't sit there and vary a whole lot. Whereas usually when a black hole eats gas and dust, it actually sits there and it can get brighter and dimmer and get brighter again. It can kind of act very chaotically. So that distinction between those two will help us distinguish between what's kind of more normal behavior for these black holes and extreme behavior like these tidal sorption events.
Well, this is all very fascinating stuff, but I'll admit it's a little terrifying, so I'm comforted that we're looking at this through the lens of a telescope billions of miles away.
Yeah, so luckily, the nearest supermassive black hole to the sun is at the center of our own galaxy, which is about 26,000 light years away. We actually can take images of stars orbiting our own supermassive black hole, the center of our galaxy, which has actually been done with Keck on Mauna Kea. But luckily for us, that's very far away. So that's not going to interact with our own sun. It's not going to interact with the Earth at all. So we're quite safe from supermassive black holes.
Well, at least we have that consolation. Ben, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great day.
That was Benjamin Chappie of the University of Hawaii's Institute for Astronomy. He sat down with The Conversation's Harrison Patino. Chappie is part of a team that recently witnessed the immediate aftermath of a star being violently ripped apart by a supermassive black hole. Hey, thanks for joining us on The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Now back over to Pledge Central with Ryan Finnerty and Derek Malama.